It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up later, President Obama is going to Congress for authorization for strikes against Syria. We'll talk to our resident historian about past examples of presidents and Congress taking steps toward war. First, the impact of an uncertain job market on our lives outside of work. Our next guest is the co-author of a new study. It's Intimate Inequalities, Love and Work in a Post-Industrial Landscape, finding that the decline of stable working-class jobs is making it harder to get married, stay married, raise children. Sarah Corse is with us. She's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Virginia. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, first, let's talk about the changing nature of work before we get into how it affects family. How are things changing in general for middle-class America versus working-class America?
Well, lots of changes have come about, as most of us have recognized in our own lives. But in particular, I think we can point to the rise of insecurity in work. And the kinds of jobs that were available, perhaps, in the post-war generation in this country, stable, blue-collar jobs, often unionized, paying a kind of a wage that allowed people to support a family, buy a home, take vacations, have benefits. Those kinds of jobs are increasingly rare in the 21st century economy.
And now, and we talked about this when I first called you up, flexibility is a buzzword a lot for employers and employees. And that means different things, though, for those in the middle class and those in the working class. Can you talk about that a little?
Right, yeah. So flexibility for middle class people may mean some insecurity, but it often also has benefits. So, for instance, freelance writers or people who work from home as contract laborers may be able to combine things like child rearing with work. But flexibility in working class jobs is more likely to mean high insecurity. I think we talked about the example of motel and hotel housekeeping staff. And for them, flexibility may mean that the hotel flexibility is maximized because people don't know if they're going to work until the morning of the day that they're going to work. They call in and find out if there's need for their services. So the ability to maintain a constant stream of income may be really affected.
And the ability to know if you need childcare tomorrow.
Exactly. Planning becomes much more difficult.
So let's get to the heart of your paper. You set out to find out what exactly about work and our personal lives.
I think one of the things that's especially problematic about increasing inequality in this country is that financial inequality seems to be leading to other kinds of inequality. And many people might be familiar with the idea of health inequality, that people who have insurance and good medical care have better health incomes than people who don't, so that income inequality leads to differences in health care. But in this paper, we were looking at what happens to people's personal lives under conditions of insecure work and the inability to plan or the inability to find a stable job, especially a stable job with benefits.
And you did something a little weird for social science. A lot of times it's all surveys. You actually went out and talked to a lot of people.
We did. We interviewed a large number of people. There are close to 300 people in our study at this point. We did do some survey work, but mostly we went and talked face-to-face with different kinds of people to get a sense for the emotional experiences that underlie some of the kind of statistical and demographic changes that we can see.
And what kind of stories did you hear on how income inequality is affecting our personal lives?
We know from kind of national level data that people in the working class are less likely to get married. I think the most, it's difficult to talk about some of these numbers. Before I throw out some numbers, let me just say it's difficult to talk about numbers because we only know what's happened up until now. Of course, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Most people in this country do still get married, and most women in this country do still have children. About just over 80% of women still have children. But we know that there's a difference between middle-class people and working-class people in terms of marriage rates. So marriage rates are 10 or maybe even 15% higher for middle-class people. And I should say here that when we use the term middle-class, we use graduating from college as our marker. It's not a perfect marker, but having a college degree means that you have access to certain kinds of jobs that you don't have access to without the college degree. So for women with college degree, somewhere in the low to mid-90s have historically, and by historically I mean the last 20, 25 years, gotten married, where for women without a college degree, it's somewhere in the low to mid-80s. And we don't really know, you know, for people who are in their 20s now, many of whom we talk to, we don't know what's going to happen to them, but our assumption is that those differences are going to continue. More troubling, perhaps, is that the divorce rate is much higher for people without a college degree. So if we think about, we tend to have better statistics about women for marriage and child rearing, which is a long story why that's true. But if we think about women who got married in the early 1990s, so 15, 20 years ago, we can look at divorce rates, and the divorce rates for women with college degrees in that period of time is about 15 or 16%. Whereas for women without a college degree, it's roughly twice that, so about 30%. So that even if the marriage rates are still high for both working class and middle class women, the divorce rates are quite different for working class and middle class women. So we know that marriage is harder to sustain for working class people.
Is it just as simple as having less money puts more stress on a relationship, or is there more to it than that?
I don't think you can discount how important financial resources are. I think most of us have had experiences where, being feeling broke, having financial pressure makes lots of things in life much more difficult. But I also think that the kinds of stories people have told us point to the idea that marriage is a very important relationship for people in America now in a very personal way. So almost none of the people we spoke with talked about marriage as, you know, something that they just assumed that they would do. And the choice of who you married, you simply found someone who was pretty similar to you, maybe someone you grew up with, and you married them when you're, graduated from college. And then, however it turned out, you stayed with them. Instead, people talk about marriage as a very demanding relationship that they have very high expectations of. So one of the things our interviewees talked about was the way in which their expectations of marriage may not have been met. And that, I think, is one of the places we can think about the kinds of resources more educated people with better jobs might have to put into their marriages. So if you think about the kinds of advice that you read, popular advice about your marriage, there are things like date nights, making sure you have time for the couple rather than the family. And, you know, getting child care costs money. Going on family vacations to help build bonds between parents and between parents and children costs money. Marriage counseling costs money. Other kinds of activities and that we might think of as investments in the marriage all take resources, not only of money, but of time, which is often an issue for people who don't have good control over their work time. They can't plan as well because their work is less secure.
We're talking to sociologist Sarah Corse of the University of Virginia about how a changing job world is making it more difficult to start families and keep them together, particularly for working-class Americans. You can join in. Is this your story? Have you put off marriage or having kids because you weren't sure of your employment future? How does job stress affect your ability to keep your marriage together or be a parent? Call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, email talk@wpr.org. And we'll hear some of the stories that Sarah collected in the course of her research as well. There's more coming up on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Sarah Corse from the University of Virginia stays with us. She's a sociologist, co-author of a new study called Intimate Inequalities, Love and Work in a Post-Industrial Landscape, How a Changing World, a Tough Job Market is Affecting Personal Decisions, Marriage, Family, Child Raising. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Sarah, one story that you tell in your paper that was striking as kind of tracks three generations of family, somebody who had that stable manufacturing job, his daughter and her daughter. Can you talk us through that?
Right. So this is a woman and her daughter we spoke to. They live near the Great Lakes in the kind of Rust Belt. Cindy, the mother of this generation, still lives in the town where she grew up, where she's raising her own daughter. And she talks about growing up in a very stable family. Her father worked in a manufacturing plant. Her mother was a stay-at-home mother. They had a small house. They didn't have a lot of money, but they had a car. Her mother was able to stay home for much of Cindy's childhood. There was always money for birthday presents. They went to vacation for a week every summer. And then in the 1970s, those factories began to close, and the employment unemployment rate climbed drastically in Cindy's hometown. And her own husband, who she married right out of high school, lost his job and was unable to find secure work, and he eventually abandoned Cindy and her daughter. So she moved back in at that point with her parents, but when her parents died, she was not able to keep their house on her salary as a, she worked in a kind of stop-and-go convenience store. So she lost the house, and then fearful for her own security and her daughter's, she kind of quickly married again and ended up in an abusive marriage, which she left to secure her own safety and her daughter's safety. And her daughter, Megan, was 19 when we talked to them, and Megan had finished high school but was unable to even find the kind of work her mother had in a stop-and-go. She had dreams of becoming a model. She'd had an engagement that had fizzled out when the fiancé ended up in jail. And we think of Cindy and her daughter Megan as Cindy's parents as kind of an example of the arc of what happens when that kind of good work vanishes and people are trying to make do on minimum wage jobs.
And Cindy's story being repeated, I mean, that's her personal thing, but alone there?
It is a personal story, but it's a story, I think, that captures many of the dynamics that we saw. And we can contrast her story with one of the kind of upper middle class families in our sample, a couple who've been married about 25 years. They live in the Pacific Northwest, and they both came out of working class families, but the husband managed to get through college with help from his parents, and he opened a business with some of his cousins, and the business has done quite well. And he and his wife have two children, and at one point their daughter was having trouble running with a bad crowd in high school, and they put her in a private school to turn her mind away from her friends and the trouble she was getting into, and they bought her a horse to help get her interested in a new set of activities, and that had gone quite well, and the daughter had graduated from high school and gone on and was starting college. And the couple had just had a weekend in which the two of them went away to talk about, now that both of their children were out of the house and they felt like their daughter was doing well, how were they going to recommit to their marriage? And the wife had decided that she was going to return to community college and finish her college degree, which she had never finished. And the husband decided that he was going to join the local gym and lose some of the weight that he'd accumulated working so hard, so that they were able to remain, you know, active and engaged with each other and attractive to each other. And I think that kind of contrast is very telling. You know, Cindy loves her daughter very much and is very committed to her daughter, but there isn't the same degree of things that she can give her compared to the couple in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, it seems like then that might be a self-perpetuating cycle. The middle-class family has the resources and opportunities to help their children maybe do better in the next generation. The working-class family, the Cindys of the world, don't. And so that might put the next generation in the same position or even worse than they're in.
I think that's what's discouraging for many people looking at growing inequality, right? That the ability to work hard and succeed in America, right? That the idea that the opportunity structure is there for people has been a very powerful thing. You know, many of us are descended from people who came to America with very little, and they were able to change their lives, certainly without college degrees for many of them. And the kinds of jobs that allowed people to make those changes just are in short supply these days. And some of the few people who we spoke to from the working class who were making it were people in the military or in the police or in firefighting, because those are some of the few jobs that are open to people that have stability and benefits. But of course, it's really difficult to get those jobs now.
Well, then getting back to marriage, some of the reporting on your piece, I think, was headlined things like, is marriage a luxury of the middle class now? Do you, and you've said you can't necessarily project this out to the future, but do you see a growing disparity in the ability of middle class college educated people versus working class, not college educated people to have stable marriages?
I do. And one of the things we heard from the younger people in our study that was surprising and discouraging to me was the way in which people in their late 20s and early 30s who've been to college talk about their intimate relationships as a resource, which is great, right? That they, so we talked to women, for instance, we talked to a woman who had just lost her job. And she said, you know, I'm very discouraged. I love my field. She worked in a nonprofit. And she said, I never thought I'd make a lot of money, but I really cared about my work. But now I'm kind of putting more of my effort into my husband, and we're talking about having a baby. And so I will still have a meaningful and important life, even if it turns out that my career doesn't work out. The working class kids that we talked to in the same age group were much more discouraged and much less hopeful about their future. In fact, many of them told us, you know, I just try not to think too much about the future. I can't imagine I'll ever find someone. Women would talk about, you know, wanting to be stay-at-home mothers, but the kinds of jobs they and the men they knew were able to get make it, if not impossible, at least pretty darn difficult to have a stay-at-home parent in the house with the kids or to pay for good quality childcare. So people feel really caught in their desire to build families and relationships that endure.
I know you didn't write this with policy prescriptions in mind, but are there things, I mean, what would it take to bring, I guess, hope for positive relationships back to the people that you're talking about?
Right. I don't want to sound naive, but, you know, I think one of the costs of the global economy is the outsourcing of a lot of kinds of jobs and our all of us as Americans, you know, our desire for cheap products, you know, and hey, I love Costco, you know, I go buy the cheap products myself. But I think we need to think more seriously about what the cost is to society as a whole to pursue lowered costs to the extent that we drive a whole set of people out of work. Not everyone should need to go to college, in my opinion, right? College isn't for everyone. There should be a route for meaningful, useful, practical kinds of work that allow people dignity and a living wage, in my opinion.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That was Sarah Corse, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Virginia. I'll put a link to at least a summary of her paper up on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up, presidents, Congress, and war, what history can tell us about the current news about Syria. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back in the air with me tomorrow. Coming up on Central Time, low-income teenagers may face a digital divide, a lack of access to online technology that could affect their future in school and at work. First, President Obama is going to Congress for authorization for military action in Syria. This isn't the first time we've been here, so we called up historian Jonathan Pollack. He joins us from time to time to talk about what America's past tells us about our present. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, we were talking just before the news. The modern state affairs, when it comes to Congress, the president, and war, goes back to the Vietnam era. Let's start with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Talk us through, remind us what happened there.
Sure thing. So there had been small incursions by the U.S. abroad throughout the 20th century. They'd always been very small scale. And in 1964, President Lyndon Johnson went to the American people and said that American ships had been attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin in international waters off the coast of North Vietnam. So by a vote of 98-2, the Senate authorized that Johnson pretty much had a free hand to commit American troops to fight that conflict. And the thought, at least as presented by Washington to the American public, was that this would be very quick. This would be like earlier American incursions into Haiti and the Dominican Republic and other small spots around the globe. Obviously, the Vietnam War didn't turn out that way. And as the opposition to the war became more and more mainstream, in 1973, Congress passed what was called the War Powers Act, which spelled out more clearly the president's need to get authorization for significant commitment of U.S. forces from Congress. So since 1973, for the last 40 years, we've seen this kind of back and forth where Congress often kind of asserts itself, and if the president says that he's going to commit U.S. troops, Congress says, no, wait a minute, that needs to go through Congress first. In the case of this conflict, in the case of Syria, what I think is really fascinating is that there's certainly prominent voices in Congress who are upset at Obama for taking this step, who are saying that, no, the president has to act on this one alone. Congress shouldn't be a part of it. Which is kind of an abdication of a role that Congress has often taken on.
Well, others in Congress are saying, yes, do come to Congress. You have to.
Yeah, that it's I think another fascinating thing about this current conflict in just the recent context is that since about 2000, we've been in an era of unprecedented party unity. And that is that since 2000 and maybe even since the mid-1990s, if you're a Republican in Mississippi and you're a Republican in Wisconsin or Washington State, you all have the same thing. You've got the same ideas. And whereas earlier, for most of American history, there are huge differences among the parties, this particular issue is really kind of a throwback to how politics operated in Congress before the 21st century. It's something that is in otherwise is difficult for me to explain to my students about, that once upon a time there were different flavors of Democrat and different flavors of Republican, and they broke down along urban and rural lines or liberal and conservative lines within each party. And this issue is really kind of cutting across party lines. Senators and congressmen opposed to or favoring the U.S. going into Syria come from a pretty diverse background.
Well, you gave us kind of the quick overview. I'd like to break down the steps a little bit. First of all, as we keep looking back at that 1964 Gulf of Tonkin resolution, as people reexamine the initial evidence, there was doubt, and rightly so, I guess, about the justification for that resolution.
Well, yeah, a big part of the War Powers Act in 73 was the release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971, which revealed that actually the American ships weren't in international waters. They were within North Vietnamese waters. So they were kind of, you know, just a few dozen miles off the coast of North Vietnam. And therefore, the idea that North Vietnam would shoot at those ships is much more reasonable. They foresaw a threat to their port. And took steps to avoid that, as opposed to making an unprovoked attack out in the middle of the ocean. So I think that deception that went on, where intelligence in Washington knew one thing and Johnson, at that point in 1964 at least, successfully curved it past the American people, that got people justifiably mad. They said, wait a minute, our leaders for generations have been lying to us about this, and Congress needs a more thorough investigation.
So that initial resolution in 1964 had a lot of bipartisan support. How about the War Powers Resolution in 1973 reacting to what we had learned in the last 9 years? Was that a popular thing to do?
Yeah, the War Powers Act was also real popular because by 1973, I mean, again, the deception that kind of launched the U.S. involvement in Vietnam on a large scale was well known, and the war was pretty well indefensible. I mean, there wasn't much of a pro-war contingent anywhere in the U.S. Republicans and Democrats disagreed about how to get the U.S. out of the war, disagreed about the tactics used to end it. But given the choice, should we continue or should we end, pretty much everybody was in favor of ending the war. And that trickled over into bipartisan support for the War Powers Act, that there was a general dissatisfaction with the power of the president. And there was a fear that without the War Powers Act, a future president could act like Johnson and get the U.S. committed to a long-term, difficult war under flimsy pretenses.
Well, some people are listening right now and saying, finishing your sentence, comma, like Iraq. Was that another thing that did the War Powers Resolution come up there? Congress did back that war. Did that change anything?
Yeah, that's a good point. So in Iraq, President Bush was very clearly abided by the War Powers mm-hmm. Act and built up a great deal of support in Congress across partisan lines for his war in Iraq. And I think there have been some commentators on Syria who've talked about how in some ways the whole question of Congress debating whether or not to send missiles into Syria is kind of a charade. It kind of doesn't matter. And in some ways, I think Iraq is responsible for that idea that even if Congress debates on it, there's not necessarily a guarantee that the administration's intelligence is necessarily perfect. As in the Iraq war, the U.S. is again depending on communications from exile groups, from groups who have left Syria, who could be wonderful and noble people, but also have a vested interest in toppling the present government. So there's some, there's some concern that even if Congress deliberates with the information they have, as in the case of Iraq, it could turn out that, oh, whoops, the information they were given was faulty and they came to this conclusion based on flawed evidence.
Two other hotspots for the War Powers Resolution since its passage, Ronald Reagan and Nicaragua in the 80s, and then Bill Clinton and Kosovo in the 1990s. Can you touch on the controversies there and how the War Powers Resolution played into it?
Yeah, sure thing. So in the case of Nicaragua, that's a case where the Congress voted decisively not to get involved in Nicaragua in a major way. But at the same time, Reagan was still able to kind of end run around the War Powers Act. That was the genesis of the Iran-Contra scandal that happened during the last couple years of his term. By channeling weapons to Iran, funneling the money into a fund for the Contras fighting to topple the Nicaraguan government, Reagan was able to accomplish some of his goals without Congress's approval and all in kind of a back channel sort of way. In the case of Kosovo, there also Clinton faced a great deal of opposition. Ultimately, Clinton was able to get NATO backing in Kosovo and was able to send, again, mostly air support and missiles in. I think in both of these, one of the ways that they attracted less controversy and less opposition than the Iraq War, especially in its later stages, or Vietnam, was the absence of troops on the ground. Was that they didn't escalate to that point where there are large numbers of American soldiers going over and fighting on the ground. Clearly, Obama is hoping to do the same thing in Syria. He hasn't really talked about a major commitment of U.S. forces. He's talking about remote warfare and so forth. But you can never be sure of those things. War is very hard to predict the eventual outcome.
Big picture, talking about Syria and beyond, we had this War Powers Act in 1973 intended to resolve the role of Congress and the president in war. It's still a gray area if you talk to either side of that.
It's definitely a gray area. I mean, the War Powers Act is one example of many in the transition to what political scientists and historians call the imperial presidency. And that is the idea of a separation of powers where Congress makes these deliberations and then the president acts on it and so forth is fine in the abstract, but in the reality of the personalities who get into politics, the president wants to be able to act. The president wants to do stuff and is often going to chafe at Congress. Congress is going to assert its authority and the president will assert his authority and will try to find other ways within the executive branch to achieve his goals. The struggle over the War Powers Act is just one of many examples of the give and take between the presidency and Congress.
John, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That was Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He joins us from time to time to put today's news in historical context. Coming up, low-income teens are having trouble applying for college, applying for jobs because of a lack of online access and related technical skills. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time. One in five households in the U.S. still goes without access to the internet, but our next guest suggests the digital divide is more complicated than that. Oftentimes, low-income teenagers only access the internet through smartphones. That's handy, but it doesn't necessarily help them with standard computers, a liability in the workplace. Jessica Goodman is with us. She's a freelance journalist. Her recent article for Mashable is called "The Digital Divide is Still Leaving Americans Behind." Jessica, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you looked at a public school in Newark, New Jersey, but I'm guessing this story is probably true in a lot of areas around the country. But how did the students you looked at access the internet?
A lot of the students that I spoke with were able to access the internet only through their smartphone, whether it was a Galaxy or an Android or an iPhone, and that was only in very specific cases. Most of these students were only able to access it when they were around available Wi-Fi. That might be a hotspot at McDonald's, and at some point that meant that they were spending all day at McDonald's. And in the case of the students that I spoke with, they didn't have internet access at school. There was no Wi-Fi in their Newark public school, and so at some point, students would even turn their phones into hotspots and charge their peers money or bus tokens to have access to that Wi-Fi. So it made it really difficult for a lot of students to be connected in the way that most other teenagers who have, you know, home Wi-Fi are able to.
Well, I think people maybe of earlier generations like me might think, well, so what? I didn't have the internet as a kid when I was in school. How does that get in the way of them, first of all, doing their work in school?
Yeah, so a lot of the teachers that I spoke with who worked at this public school found it incredibly difficult to give assignments where research was involved, because now most of the research that students do is on the internet. And even when they did give research-based projects, a lot of their students hadn't grown up with computer or internet access readily available. So when they had access to school computers, they might do something like take the first paragraph they read off of Wikipedia and take it at face value, simply because they had not learned how to research the internet properly. And that was only when the internet was available. So a lot of teachers ended up giving your traditional reading and writing assignments where you might have to write an essay using your hands, which is actually very uncommon nowadays. One teacher that I spoke with said that his students at the Newark Public School had less computer literacy skills than he had in 1999 when he was in high school. which is baffling in the age that we live in, where you walk around and pretty much everyone is ducked. You know, their heads are ducked and they're on their smartphone, or a lot of people who are just constantly connected to the internet, whether they're on a computer, a phone, or Google Glass. But for people who only have Wi-Fi access on a phone, it becomes increasingly difficult to keep up with the internet age.
Well, and even something that a lot of people now might take for granted, like typing a paper on a Word document. You could do it on a phone, I guess, but it would be very difficult, I imagine. I wouldn't want to try to do that. Are these students not getting some of those basic skills that a lot of people will need in college or the workplace?
Yeah, absolutely. Because a lot of these students didn't grow up with computers, doing something that might seem simple to somebody who had grown up with a laptop at home, it takes them twice or three times as long to finish a paper. One teacher said that she did have a student turn in a paper that was entirely written on her phone, and she forwarded me the paper, and you know, there are just tons of typos and grammatical errors that you might suspect to see in an email that was typed on a phone, you know, with the end where it says, "Send for my iPhone, sorry for all the errors." This was someone's high school paper, that this is the only way that they were able to write a paper in their minds, I guess. And, you know, some of the teachers I spoke with said that they might give 10 or 15 extra credit points if you turned in your paper that was written on a computer. But a lot of times it just took the students so much longer to write a paper on a computer than it would by hand, because they might not know how to use Microsoft Word, or they might not know how to, you know, save a file, or where to save it, or where to find it once they saved it, because they didn't have the access or the ability to use a computer at home or to use a computer constantly at school. Whereas students who grow up, in middle class or upper middle class families where computers are readily available, those skills are just innate to them, and it becomes second nature. You know, Command S equals save and Command P equals print. A lot of students who don't have access to computers have no idea what that means.
And the phrase digital divide is in your headline, and that's the big issue, isn't it? That the kids you're looking at, the low-income kids, are starting 10 feet behind everybody else because they don't have those basic skills as they enter college or enter the workforce.
Absolutely. And when teachers try to, you know, help them in any way they can, a lot of teachers I spoke with expressed the feeling that it felt like putting a Band-Aid over a bullet hole, that there's just such a lag that comes from not using a computer every day of your life, that it becomes really difficult to catch up to the rest of society, even in the workforce.
So what happens when the kids you're looking at there think about applying for college? Applying for college is a big pain in the butt anyway with the computer. How much higher of a hurdle is it if you don't have those skills coming out of high school?
I mean, it's just incredibly difficult because so many of the applications are online now. And if you want to apply online, if you don't have a computer, I mean, it's nearly impossible to apply to college on your smartphone. And so a lot of students will take the time to work in libraries. In New York City, the New York Public Library System is a place where many, many low-income students go to use the computers every day, and they often do use it to apply for jobs and apply for college. But without a computer, it just becomes incredibly difficult. And then even if you do get to college, how do you go about using computers in college when you've never really done that in high school? But more importantly than applying to college and filling out FAFSA forms are the students who opt not to go to college and try to enter the workforce immediately after high school. More than 80% of Fortune 500 companies now require online job applications. And even though that number doesn't seem very high, when you look at non-Fortune 500 companies, just small businesses in your cities, fast food joints, nearly all of them will tell you when you walk in to apply for a job, "Oh, just go to our website. You can fill out a job application there." And that's where, you know, it becomes just, like I keep saying, incredibly difficult.
So in the research that you did and the people you talked to, are there thoughts about what kind of solutions people are looking for and hopefully cost-effective ones?
Yeah, absolutely. Some experts that I spoke with said that we need to, that America as a whole needs to look towards Europe and see what they're doing in order to get broadband internet readily available to almost everyone in the country. People keep saying that we need to look at the internet as a basic human right now. It's like what the telephone was in the early 20th century. It's just become such a necessity for everybody to have it. And without having basic broadband, by the government's definition, you're pretty much not a human. You're not able to keep up just with everything that's going on in the world. So a lot of people say that we need to have government regulation on the internet and destroy the monopolies kind of that have come up in certain cities of the internet providers and make it more financially feasible. And then there are also programs like Connect to Compete is one that offers low income, or it offers internet to low income families. But in order to get that, you have to there are a lot of restrictions in terms of how much money you make and if you have children and if they qualify for reduced fare lunches. That's one of the requirements it takes to get your internet to about $10 a month, which is some of the lowest rates in the country for internet ever.
And then that broadband, just briefly, that broadband's just half the battle. In about 20, 25 seconds, how about getting computers in the hands of those people then?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the other part of this problem is that there need to be just more readily available computers for Americans. There are netbooks that are way cheaper than getting, a MacBook Pro or something like that. But in order to get that, there just needs to be more computers available and more people making computers in order to get them in the hands of everybody.
Gotcha. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. That's Jessica Goodman, freelance journalist based in New York. Coming up tomorrow at Central Time, speaking of technology, we'll do a nostalgia segment with the continuing appeal of typewriters. And as it turns out, messy desks can actually help our creativity. That's good news for me. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a mobile recording studio, possibly in the works for Native Americans, part of an effort to boost creativity, creative outlets, and prevent suicide. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.